Welcome to the Property Management Mastermind Show with your host, Brad Larson. Brad owns one of the fastest growing property management companies in San Antonio, Texas. This podcast is for property managers by property managers. You'll hear from industry leading professionals on best practices, new ideas, success stories, and lessons learned. This is your opportunity to learn about the latest industry buzz surrounding property management, as well as tips and strategies to improve your business. Now here's your host, Brad Larson.
Today's show is sponsored by the National Property Management Network, providing insurance products and services to property managers such as tenant liability insurance. Visit them at nationalpropertymanagement.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Property Management Mastermind. In today's episode, I have Justin Badgema, and he is a property management company owner from Michigan who just recently moved to Texas. Now, it's going to be a very powerful interview that I want you to hang on and listen to, because Justin's going to talk about his experience in the military and how he got into an organization called Warrior's Heart. This is an organization that I've been very impressed with. I would encourage all property management company owners out there and all folks listening to take a look at it and help contribute in any way possible you can. And we're going to share with you a couple techniques on how you can do that. So this is going to be an excellent interview with Justin, and I think you're going to be very excited to hear some of the things he's talking about. We're going to get deep into owning a property management company and also his involvement with Warrior's Heart. Very good stuff. So just take a listen. And Justin, thanks for being in studio today. How are you doing today?
Doing great, Brad. Thanks for having me.
Big honor having you here. I really appreciate you coming in, doing the podcast with me. So to kick this right away, get into talking about some things that we want to touch on. So tell me a little bit about how you got into property management. Just kind of go a little bit background there. Walk me through kind of how you got into the management side and what intrigued you about real estate property management.
Well, Brad, it was a lifelong dream as a young boy to be a property manager.
Oh, I'm sure it wasn't. I'm sure you woke up in fifth grade and said, boom, I'm going to be a property manager.
That's the thing. Yeah. No, totally fell into it. But it actually started back in 2003. I was coming back from Iraq.
Okay.
And we were floating across the sea, and I got a care package from my aunt and uncle. And they sent me this package, and inside this package was a purple book. Mm-hmm. And that purple book was Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And I read that book, and it just changed my life, to be quite honest with you. So read that book, and I got the real estate bug. And I ended up getting out of the Marine Corps in 2005. And knew I wanted to do real estate, started learning out how to try to figure out how to do it. But I started building houses with a buddy, mm-hmm. really learning the trade, but then started investing in single family homes in 2007, 2008. It got to the point where there was enough of them where it came down to a management function. So kind of looked around the marketplace. Coming from a professional Marine Corps background, I wanted things done a certain way. Right. And I didn't see that happening in the marketplace. So we created a new property management company.
Yeah. That's so ironic that you got into real estate because of that book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, from Robert Kiyosaki. For anybody watching on YouTube, I have a list and stack of books up there. And a lot of those books on tape are from Robert Kiyosaki himself. And I read that book in 1999, 2000. And I was at the Infantry Captain's Career Course at Benning. I think I told you this story, but a buddy from Vanderbilt said, hey, man, you got to read this book. It'll change your life. And it really has, because it changes your mindset.
Totally.
From, let's say, an employee base, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But it kind of gives you that entrepreneurial bug, let's say, like you mentioned, mm-hmm. and it puts you on a different path, let's say, and working for yourself and doing things in real estate, et cetera. So great example. You and I are one and the same there. It's really cool. So forming a management company, was it out of necessity, you said? Talk about more.
Yeah. Had no idea what I was getting myself into. Okay. You know, they say that starting your own business, you have to be dumb enough to do it. And I think there's some validity to that, because you don't know what you don't know. And I think if we did know on the front end, we might not do it. So, mm-hmm. you know, in all fairness, we just said, let's do this, me and my wife, and we did it. So we started with zero doors. We started with nothing. Actually, the way we started to back up a little bit is she went to go work for one of our competitors. And we were, full disclosure, didn't hide anything from them. You know, we didn't steal anything from them, but we just said, hey, we're really interested in property management. Mm-hmm. And he was a great guy, and he had just started out too, and kind of took my wife under his wings. And from there, she learned a little bit of the systems and the process behind it. And that was very valuable to us. But we were going to do it one way or the other. And right. I think it just kind of helped us out. So.
And that transition into you guys owning several properties, owning yep. several multifamily and even single family residences.
Yep. Started single family homes, and mm-hmm. then we started investing. And then I'd say after we started doing the single families for a little while, it was back in 07, 08 during the crash when things were going down, we bought all the way down. But I think there's part of me where I got a little bit distracted from my true love of investing and was so focused on the company, you know, and it takes a lot of effort to build a company. You know, it takes a lot of effort to do something from scratch. As you know, you built yours from zero doors too. And back then when we first started, we didn't know about ARPM. I wish we would have, you know, I went through all the other organizations, you know, IRM and NAA, just all the different organizations, but didn't find ARPM until I think 2012 or 2013. And once we found it, I mean, that was definitely the fuel on the fire for us. That totally took it to a totally different level.
Now, you guys had to set up your own chapter. Is that correct?
Yeah, we did. I mean, we believe so much. So me and my wife, and we'd actually send our employees, our team members to national events too, because we believed in it so much. The impact for us is so great. You know, the learning curve was so huge. There's so much to absorb and take in. You know, it's prolific, still I'm a prolific note writer, but going to these events, it's just like, oh my gosh, there's just so much good stuff here. You know, and we'd go back and incorporate that into our company. But that made a huge, huge, huge difference. So, I mean, if there's listeners that aren't attending NARPM conferences, I mean, that's where you got to start for sure. Don't try to recreate the wheel when someone else has already done that work.
Right.
You know, you can take that wheel and maybe make it your own by adjusting a little bit, but don't, you know, don't be foolish like me and try to do it from scratch.
Yeah, one thing we've learned, or at least I have for sure, and I started attending NARPM conferences in 2013, 2014, you start to take a lot of notes in the beginning, but towards the latter conferences, it does kind of taper off, but you still have to go. You still have to learn new techniques.
Yeah. You know,
you got to implement what you learn. I can't say that enough.
Totally agree. So the way I always looked at it is like, if I could walk away with one valuable item that would pay for the conference that I could implement in my business, to me, that was valuable enough to go to a conference. I've never gone to a conference, I don't think, that I haven't gotten something that I can take away from and implement. So to me, that was always my mindset. You know, the ROI had to be that it basically paid for itself. I could add into the business. But we also look at it from a residual perspective, not just once. I didn't want to build a business where I had to go back out there like a realtor and have to do the same thing every single month. Mm-hmm. The thing that I love about property management is it's a residual based business.
Right.
You do work once, you get paid for the next 12 months, if not more.
Exactly. And talk more with us about how you set up your business. And now you're essentially owning from a distance. I really want to hear, I know the listeners want to hear about that because I've heard several success stories. I've shared them with you about folks building up a management company and then maybe not even living in that state. So talk more about that.
Yeah. So we're from Grand Rapids, Michigan, and that's where we created the company and was very involved. Wife was very involved. She had to be, we had to be. I mean, we started with nothing and very quickly we had a baby on the way. So it was make it or break it. You know, we tried all the different business models, went from a portfolio management style to a department management style to a hybrid. You know, we tried all the things that you hear at NARPM, and they're all great things to hear and to implement and try to figure out what works for you. But we tried all of them. But the thing that from day one was very important to us is that we wanted to work on our business. And so from day one, when we started making a profit, which we actually kind of did from day one, but we put it back into the company right away. You know, we invested in technology, and technology for me was something I was definitely gravitated towards. I saw the benefits of leverage of systems. And so, yeah, we focused our time and energy on building systems and processes. And there's a book that we read, Rich Dad Poor Dad, was a great book to kind of start that process. But from a business perspective, the book E-Myth was very influential for me.
And that's called Entrepreneurial Myth, not Electronic Myth.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So people think E-Myth, oh, like email. No, it's kind of talks about, you know, the myths involved in being an entrepreneur, some of the things that you may want to elaborate on.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so one of them is I mean, burnout's real. Right. So there's a point where being a business owner can still be a job. And we got to that point where working really, really, really hard to make this thing work, you know, getting off the ground and growing and all that stuff. But there's a point where for me, I didn't enjoy managing employees. I love leading people and building a team and doing things with them like that, you know, helping them grow and seeing that personal development take off inside of them. I love that nurturing thing. But I hate managing people. Did you do this? Did you do that? And that, so that was definitely not the culture that we wanted. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to be intentional. You have to figure out, what do you want? Why are you creating a business? What are you in business for? You know, and for me, maybe some events in my life that we'll probably get to later probably helped reinforce the clarity of what I did want out of a company and what I did not want out of a company. But I didn't want to spend my whole time, you know, 70, 80 hours a week, because that's what I was working.
Yeah.
You know, in the early years, definitely put the time into it. You know, I've done every function in the company. I've done leasing. I've been sales, done the lead gen, done, you know, the maintenance. I've done everything inside the company, the books, which I'm horrible at doing. But my point is like, we've done every part of that company. So we knew it intimately. We knew inside and outside of that company. because of that intimacy, we're able to build systems around it. And so we systematized our business. We created a franchisable business, and we didn't know if we were or were not going to franchise it, and we didn't. But nonetheless, we created a system where somebody could come into it and follow a process and almost make it that broken down. You know, in the military, we'd say Barney style, but where you could step by step by step see the process. Mm-hmm. So that way, when a team member would come to me, I didn't want them coming to me and asking me for how do I do this? How do I do that? First question would be like, did you look at the process manual, procedure manual? So at least that gave them somewhere to go and to see if they can do it themselves. And if they got hung up, of course, we'd answer that question with
them. What were some of the keys in allowing you to break away from having to be in the office on a regular basis? Not only physically, but mentally. Meaning that some folks can go on vacation and have no problem because they have somebody kind of watching their stuff behind them. But to be able to be somewhere long term and not just freak out about it.
Yeah.
So there's probably going to be one or two key hires that you made. Mm-hmm. And then also changing your mindset to give them the power, the capability to make those decisions that have to be made every day.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've got a couple of things in there.
Yeah.
So the first thing is it comes down to great people. It really does. And it sounds easier than what it really is, right? As you know. And I've made tons of mistakes hiring the wrong people. I hired a lot of people that were like me. You know, I thought that was great. They're driven. They're entrepreneurial. I'll tell you what, when there's a lot of one person running around a company, that's disastrous.
Yeah. I have an old joke about that, saying that employers, there's two types of employers. The kinds that make bad hires and the kinds that lie about it.
Yeah.
Well, because there's always somebody out there saying, oh, I never made a bad hire. But my employees are always perfect. You know, they go through all the hiring steps and, you know, all the DISC profiles, and they, you know, have great incentives and all this other stuff, but it never fails. You'll always make a bad hire.
Of course. And you can't be afraid to make those mistakes.
Correct.
It's going to happen.
You know, as they say, you got to, you know, get through the weeds to find the one. And you've done that so far. You're able to find some key members that are able to take your business and help it run on its own.
Yes. It took me making a lot of dumb mistakes first. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I made a lot of wrong hires. Maybe trusting some people that maybe I shouldn't have, learned along the way, you know, got embezzled a little bit, nothing major, but basically we had someone who was taking cash, took cash one time that we know of, and we caught them. And from there on, you know what? No more cash. Mm-hmm. You know, we went fully electronic, and that's from early on. So you make those lessons, but trust is another big part of it. I mean, you have to hire the right people, but then you have to empower them. And so, like, I don't want to micromanage. Nobody wants to be micromanaged. I don't know anybody that likes to be micromanaged. And so I believe that people either live up to or live down to expectations. Mm-hmm. And so if you set the expectation, if you have the culture that resonates with them, the culture only can come from you or from me, whoever is at the top of that organization, that's where the culture comes from. And then from that, people are attracted to that. So if you have like-minded people that that believe in the things that you believe in and the same path, the same direction that you are, and they want to work in that environment, you can build a great culture that's self-policing, takes care of each other. That's what I believe in, taking care of each other. Yeah. So you have to have the back of your team members, mm-hmm. and they hopefully have your back too. But when you do it correctly, they do.
I think the system, to dive into that a little bit further, one of the techniques I think you're doing or should be doing is, let's say on the books, for example, you most likely, somebody would have a bookkeeper, like an outsourced bookkeeper that's doing all the hardcore, you know, reconciliations. You might have an internal person looking at those. And then at the same time, you may have a third party like you guys, for example, you know, from here, you and or your wife, mm-hmm. looking at those books to say, yeah, everything makes sense. So you have three kind of checkpoints.
Yeah, separation there. Of powers.
Correct. Separation of powers. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things in the CRMC checklist for NARPM that they look at, is having a three-tiered type of a system for looking at the numbers. That way it kind of can hone in on potential embezzlement ideas. Now, the fact that you caught that is great. I think that's going to happen to every business at some point.
Absolutely.
And if you say, oh, it's never going to happen, then you're lying to yourself. Mm-hmm. You really are. But the fact that you're able to catch it and mitigate that, change policy, and you only maybe lost a small amount. I mean, nothing that's over the top. Mm-hmm. It's the folks that, you know, they don't have those systems in place. Now, all of a sudden, you have a bad employee and they're into you for $200,000 or more.
Yeah.
They get access to that trust account and they're siphoning off of that trust account that nobody's catching because you're not keeping the books well enough. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to hire a full-time bookkeeper. We don't have one. You know, we outsource bookkeeping, and that's end up being, let's say it's 20 hours a week or 20 hours a month, whatever it's going to be, 4 hours a week, for example. You can get that at a very cost-effective rate. I would recommend to anyone who's got a small company, outsource your books. And if you remember, remember a point Kiyosaki made, is he said to outsource everything, to include your company books and your personal books.
Yeah.
Remember when you said that?
Yep.
And so it took me a little while to catch that. And about a year ago, we started doing that with our bookkeeping sources. Is that bookkeeper outsourced here in town, locally owned, you know, locally mm-hmm. set up. They're doing our company books, all the reconciliations. We get monthly reports. And she's doing our personal books. Mm-hmm. So when we go to the CPA, it's just a data dump from the bookkeeper to the CPA, and he's knocking out our taxes.
Yep.
So that's a good technique. I think you guys are doing that, something similar as well. I'm just going to tell you what we're doing. Mm-hmm. That's part of why we're talking. It's not a one-way conversation, but it's a media to throw out stuff that what we're doing. So hopefully somebody listening can say, oh, that's a good idea. Maybe we should do that versus Agnes, the bookkeeper at 40 grand a year, mm-hmm. 50 grand a year, sitting in my office, punching out my books for me where she's twiddling her thumbs
yeah.
4 hours a day.
And it's interesting you say that, you know, just talking about this coming up, and we position ourselves for growth, mm-hmm. you know, staff heavy. And I think we all make that mistake. Same thing. And then they justify that position. So that was actually the last major one that we got rid of was our bookkeeping, our in-house accounting. Mm-hmm. And they were paid, you know, a decent amount of money. It was a good revenue stream for them.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it was an expense suck for us.
Yeah.
And the reality is today, there's so much that you can outsource and leverage with technology and different companies that can do it better. The way that we looked at it internally was, if this is not our core thing, if this is not the core service that we provide, and what we define as our core service is what's high touch, high yield, high benefit. And what that is it's having hands-on, interacting with the owners one-on-one, interacting with the residents one-on-one, and managing that property.
The important stuff.
That's exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You know, the numbers are hugely important. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But there's ways that you can do that where someone can do it better than what you could do it.
Yep.
Cheaper, faster, better. And so
Nowadays you can do QuickBooks and all that stuff online completely.
Oh yeah.
You know, you can either have the full version on a portal and somebody anywhere in the world can log in and do your books for you.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing it that way. But we found a local solution that turns out to be great for us. And you're going to pay, you know, $45 an hour, but darn it, they can knock that stuff out in 2 hours versus where it might take an in-person 6 hours.
So the mistake is to look at the top line number. I think you have to look at the value. You know,
yeah.
To me, it's about value, not about the cost.
Yeah. And you've heard of Parkinson's law, that chipping in. You know, if you give somebody 2 hours worth of work in an 8 hour time frame, they're going to take 8 hours to do 2 hours of work. You know, the Parkinson's law theory. So I always think that's true for bookkeepers in-house, unless you're at scale. If you have a couple thousand doors, then sure. But, you know, for smaller companies, you know, we're at 600 plus. I think you were around 300-400 somewhere in there. You know, those types of companies, they're just not enough revenue flying around to justify an in-house full-time bookkeeper, because I think you can build better systems, better solutions around it.
Yeah. And Brad, I think that goes even more into bookkeeping. I think that can be the traditional mindset of an employee. And I think it's something to be very careful of. And so what we did is we moved away from the big heavy. I mean, we were way overstaffed. That was definitely where all my, you know, all the money was going. I mean, your staff is a huge, huge, it is the largest expense that you have.
Yeah. It should be around 50%.
Well, ours was more.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the kind of the rule of thumb, the line in the sand, as they say, 50%. And that could be from a small company to a large company, because we've seen all the NARPM numbers, and that's the number I like to use, and that's my benchmark. So if we're at 55, okay, that's fine. If we're at 45, okay, great, that's even better. But it shouldn't be like 75-80%. That's just too much. And we're talking a lot about the books, mm-hmm. because I'm envisioning myself moving to New Zealand and or Alaska, one of my other favorites, and managing a company from a distance. And it's all a pipe dream because, you know, kids are in school here. We're not moving anywhere. But point being is, what if we did?
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I'm checking off the box is, okay, do I have solid bookkeeping to where, one, I can see it, and I've got two or three other people looking at it in addition to me?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, all right, we beat up that dead horse pretty well. You have any other comments on that?
No, I mean, we did it. And the last thing for us was going completely electronic with all of our AP, our accounts payable, doing mm-hmm. all of our, you know, I'm a huge tech advocate. I love technology. I love seeing the direction where it's going. I think it's amazing. I think there's so much more to come down the pipeline. To me, we can't be complacent. I think we need to be, you know, stay relevant, stay on top of the change that's happening. Change is constant. Change will never stop.
Elaborate on that, you're sending all your vendors' bills electronically?
We are.
That is slicker than, I can't say a bad word.
Yep. We are completely away from paper checks.
That is cool.
On all accounts. We do receive, I think, a few incoming checks from tenants, which do get scanned.
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, years ago, we got rid of doing the bank deposits. That's a huge liability in so many different ways.
Yes.
Employee driving to a bank, there's a risk, car accident. I mean, all those different types of things. But the few paper checks that we do get, we're now charging a administrative processing fee because that takes time and energy for somebody to scan that check and then do the entry on the books as well.
Yeah, do you know where you are in the percentages? So for example, we're at, I think, 89% pay online. And I'd like to see 100%, but there are people that just pay money orders and checks. You can't really get away from it. But the vendors, man, that's a cool deal. Yep. I think that's something that, that should be a lesson learned for us for sure. We could try to look into that because I sign way too many paper checks. It's getting to be kind of, you know, silly. We got to start figuring out a way to get rid of that.
It's also a security risk.
It is. It is. People get your account number, your routing number. They get all that information out there. So I think that's going to be a lesson learned from this podcast is we're going to look more into transitioning into paying vendors all electronically. And that should be a good lesson learned for anybody listening.
Yeah. You know, if your software doesn't give you the level of control that you want, one of the things that we did is we use Chase Bank. We have a great business banking relationship.
And you can say which software you're on. It's okay.
Yeah. We're a proper user.
Okay.
Have been for years. Good, bad, and ugly. But we're so vested into it where I don't see the value in changing.
Yeah. That's the thing. Just to dive into that a few minutes. So I think the softwares, they all equally suck.
Yeah. Right.
It's just you got to find the one that sucks the least.
Yeah.
And that's not a knock against any of them. They're all good folks. They're all good providers. At the end of the day, they never fit your persona 100%.
Nothing solves everything.
And, you know, we looked at switching from A to B a while back and my GM smacked me in the head and said, "Hey man, is this going to make us any more money?" And I took me back. I'm like, "Yeah, you're exactly right. It's not going to make us any more money. Mm-hmm. We're going to go through all this headache to switch. It's going to cost me $5,000 or $10,000 in back office to do it. And it's just potentially not worth it." You know, you get to a certain level and that's one of the things I preach in is pick a software and make it work.
Yep, commit to it.
Make it work. Yep. You know, it, right, wrong, or other, they're all going to do the same functions. Mm-hmm. If they can't, they're going to catch up eventually to be able to do that. And so I think the software side is all pick one or the other. They're all about the same.
Yeah. You know, people have their favorites, you know, this one's doing better or whatever, you know, there's moments for regret, you know, for sure. Moments of doubt, like, man, did I pick the right one? But you know what though? Do what works for you. And the reality is that, you know, when I look at our profit margin, it's working for us, you know, it's working for us. So going back to the online payments, my point was though, even with Chase Bank, you know, if you're writing paper checks today, if you're cutting them out to vendors, you can go into like Chase Bank and have a dual pay activation, like where there's dual control. So you can have your bookkeeper enter that, but you have to approve it or someone else have the right proper authority has to approve it.
That's cool.
They're not charging you for the postage. They're not charging you for the check stock. They're not charging you for the micker toner. I mean, all those things are things that cost you administratively in your office today. You know, the stamps, the postage, the envelopes. I mean, all that stuff adds up and the time to process that stuff.
Yeah.
It adds up. So you can do that today for free through your major banking associations.
Yeah, we're going to have to look into that. I'm very, that's one of the things that got put on the back burner, let's say, a little bit, because we were looking at it, but we never perfected it. So, yeah. God, thanks for reminding me about that. That's great stuff.
I'll send you an invoice for that tip.
Yes, you won't. Yes, you won't. So you're up and running. You're a long distance. I got to tell a quick story how we met. This is good for the audience. So we're in West Palm Beach at the PM Grow Summit, Property Management Grow Summit, which is a phenomenal event put on by 4.5 and Lead Simple. Alex and Jordan did a phenomenal time putting that thing on. That was a major event. I mean,
it was great.
Big
it was
time. Great event. So I'd recommend anybody go to that. And of all places, you and I met in West Palm Beach.
Yeah.
In Florida.
Yep.
And I heard through the grapevine, we're at this mixer and this guy just moved to Texas. And I asked you a question. You moved to Texas? You say, yep. And I said, where? You said, San Antonio. And you say, yep. And really, San Antonio, where? And you say, my neighborhood? I'm like, holy cow, we're neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
Of all places, I meet my neighbor in West Palm Beach. So point being, we're fellow property management company owners. You're a veteran, which is one of the things that I honed in on right away. I'm prior service. You know, I was an infantry guy, an officer, which I hated, but hey, well, whatever. I was an infantry guy and you were an infantryman in the Marine Corps.
I was.
So tell me more about this because this is going to transition nicely into what we really want to talk about that's very important today.
Yeah, absolutely. I joined the Marine Corps in May, so stick with me on the dates here, but May 20 of 2001 is when I went into the Marine Corps.
Right before 9/11.
Yeah, exactly.
4 months, 5 months.
Yeah. So I graduated boot camp and, you know, you come home for a week or whatever it is. And I went back to my school of infantry training. And I think it was the first or second day that we just started training. It was 9/11. That was kind of the tone for the rest of my 4 years in the Marine Corps.
Yeah. And you had how many deployments?
Yeah. So from there, I served two tours in Iraq, did two rotations through Iraq. And on my second tour, I was severely injured twice. First time, my vehicle flipped over on top of me in a canal. It's a 20,000 pound eight-wheeled vehicle. It's called the LAV-25. It's like a tank on wheels, essentially.
Yeah.
And I was pinned upside down in the vehicle for 45 minutes with it crushing me, basically crushing me to death. And the only thing that saved me that day was that I didn't bring my sidearm to the field. When I was upside down, it's 130 degrees out, had diesel fuel running all over, ignition switch is still on. So I got all these thoughts. I couldn't move. After the vehicle stopped moving and we're upside down, the only thing I could move was my one arm. And I'm wiping sweat off my face and there's diesel fuel running all over us. And everybody's like, are you okay? Are you okay? And everybody gets out of the vehicle and they try pulling me out and I wouldn't budge. I mean, I was stuck against the vehicle in the canal upside down. They started digging me out. And as they're digging me out, the vehicle is falling on me more and more. So then they hooked up some winches to the vehicle and trying to winch it back to be able to pull me out. And they did that and the winches gave out in the vehicle. So each time they keep doing this stuff, it's falling on me more and more. And so I got to a point where I just mentally and physically, I mean, I was getting crushed to death. And I made a decision that I didn't want to endure the pain anymore. And so literally reaching down my sidearm, but it was the one day I didn't bring my Beretta 9mm to the field. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here with you. They ended up getting me out. I think they had three vehicles winch up to it, pulled me out. You know, the second they pulled me out, the vehicle falls back on top of itself. But the thing that was difficult wasn't the banged up, bruised up ribs. I mean, they shot me up morphine to take care of the pain, that kind of stuff. And I went to a medical fob. Actually, I think I went up to by Baghdad. But it wasn't the pain. It was that I lost my confidence and I was scared and I still had, you know, most of my deployment ahead of me. This is my second tour. And so I spent the next 6 weeks in country, recuperating, and then I banged up my ribs and I was really sore. You know, it was hard to move around. I had 20,000 pounds on me. The thing that saved my life was the sappy plate, which is the body armor, but I had to go back out there and it tore me apart to see my guys going out there without me. The fact that I knew that they're putting their life on the line, you know, they're dealing with the crap day in and day out, and I was somewhat safe, you know, back in the rear at the fob. And I really struggled with that. So as the vehicle commander for my vehicle, I mean, I had to get back up on that vehicle. And I can tell you that was probably one of the hardest damn things I've ever done, is get back on top of the vehicle that nearly, I'm looking at this vehicle. I mean, it's the same vehicle that was on top of me, you know, and I had to climb back on that thing and I was shaking. And I went back out, and the very next time, the very first time I went out, we got ambushed and hit next 5 days in a row. And yeah, it was intense. It was very intense. I've seen the first time we went out, the guy in front of me, who normally I was point man, he took my position. I watched him get blown up the first night. Second night, I watched my buddy behind me get blown up. So that was the reality of it. And then November 29, 2004, we were on a nighttime patrol on a canal road, which is the same type of canal road that my vehicle had flipped over the first time. But this time, we were doing it at night, blacked out, no lights. So we're just using our thermal vision, our night vision goggles. And we went around a corner, and we just started. And went around a corner, completely blacked out. We're probably going 5 miles per hour. And I heard over the net, which is the radio, my wingman behind me say, I think I see... And before I got done with this sentence, we got hit. And I just remember the whole vehicle going up, just, you know, the sheer, just, it was almost like quiet, but it was violent quiet. And we came back down and I didn't know, I thought I was dead. And as soon as we came back down, my gunner pulled me out of our hole in the turret. And I crawled up to see if my driver was alive. And as soon as I went to go open his hatch to see if he is alive, machine gun fire opened up. And so I rolled off the vehicle and my gunner crawled over and laid on top of me. He put his body on top of mine to protect me. And called out for Doc, Corman. And they got up there. I had two corpsmen. One of them had all diesel fuel in his eye from getting blown up. The whole vehicle opened up like a sardine can. And ended up medevacing us out of there. I went to Saddam's hospital in Baghdad, where I had my first surgery, and I woke up and sitting next to me was a piece of shrapnel, about weighed a quarter pound, probably about 2 inches by 2 inches around. I still have it to this day, but it was in my leg.
Wow.
And so they end up saving my leg. I ended up getting medevaced out of Iraq, went to Landstuhl, Germany. And then from there, I went to Bethesda, Maryland. So I had six weeks in the hospital, eight surgeries. They saved my legs and I learned how to walk again. And so that was a major, major accomplishment, right? So at that point, I was done being an employee, done being told what to do.
Sure.
You know, no more, you know, and
you earned the right. That's for sure.
Yeah. So that's twofold right there, you know, and I give those details for two reasons. One is there's a brotherhood in the military, esprit de corps, you know, and band of brothers, whatever you want to call it. There's definitely a connection that's definitely forged, you know, in those situations of stress and whatnot. So to me, I still to this day feel a sense of obligation to those guys, to my guys. And so that's a big reason why I'm doing what I'm doing today. And what I, you know, big reason why I've been doing what I've been doing. Like one, I love business. I truly love business. I love real estate. I don't want to run a property management company day in and day out being in the nitty gritty, but I love it. I love property management. I love real estate. I love investing. But I also have a deep part of me spiritually that needs to continue to take care of our guys, you know, and there's a lot there to process, you know, and I think, unfortunately, we were treated very well when we came home, but there's earlier generations, the Vietnam generation, that was not treated very well. And I think our country has corrected those errors, but there's so much more work that needs to be done. Today, there is 22 veterans a day committing suicide. 22 veterans a day commit suicide.
Unreal.
Back home. That's over 8,000 veterans a year are committing suicide. That's way more than what we're losing overseas in combat. So that's not right, you know? And for me, when I came back, it's like, okay, how can I do something about this stuff? You know, and I wanted to find a way to take my love for business and solve it with a, you know, some kind of company that would solve a need for veterans. And you know what? I didn't find it. And what I found was I had an opportunity to use property management, my business to succeed at and to do well at, which would give me a platform to talk about this other issue of veterans issues. And that's what we did. And, I'm very thankful for the opportunities. Honestly, getting blown up is probably absolutely the hardest thing I've ever had to go through, but also the best thing that's ever happened to me.
That's deep. It's almost like you need a moment of silence just to absorb all that. And it's one of those things that people, when they hear that, they'll never be able to say, oh, I understand that, or you just can't relate. So I do want you to talk more about how that helped you kind of transition into working in some of the foundations that you have, because I think you've made a sincere giant effort in your life in big, big ways to get into that. I want you to talk more about that.
Yeah. So what we're doing currently.
Yeah. And what you've done in the past kind of with different organizations.
Yeah.
And how that transitioned into what you're doing.
Yeah. So, you know, when I first, this 2000, I got out of the Marine Corps in 2005, I was actually medically retired from my injuries. And when I got out, you know, I was still, you know, 25 years old, still, I don't want to say naive, but I was naive to some things definitely in the world. And I didn't realize, well, let me first give you a statistic here. There are about 50,000, just shy of 50,000 nonprofit veteran organizations in the United States today.
Wow.
50,000. Think about that for a second. And the amount of people that are out there, you know, trying to do good, and I believe that they're generally truly are people that are trying to make a positive impact in veterans' lives, but there are other people who are absolutely just trying to profit from this. And that was the part that I was a little bit naive to. You know, they say thank you and, you know, appreciate what you've done, thank you for your service. But I didn't quite put it together right away. Very quickly I did, but there was people that were profiting. And I saw that I was a national spokesperson for an organization. And it was insane. It was insane what was happening with that money. And so as a sidebar here, if you're ever going to donate to a nonprofit charity, which is great, you know, I believe in charitable things and being philanthropic, but look at the organization, look at their financials, look at how much money is going to the bottom line of actually impacting, making a betterment in someone's life. Because otherwise what you see is it gets eat up in administration, it gets eat up in, you know, salaries. I mean, there's executives who are making 10 million plus. You know, there's some large numbers in the nonprofit world. So anyway, just do your homework. Make sure you look at the organization. And just because they have a bunch of flashy TV commercials, you know, maybe those are ones you need to take a deeper look at.
Well said. Yeah, it's interesting. I can hear more about that from you, especially the 50,000 charitable
organization.
That's a lot. Do you have any stats that you could throw out just for, you know, for every dollar you give, potentially X goes to the real bottom line of actually helping somebody?
Well, I mean, it totally depends on the organization.
Right.
It's all over across the board. So
is there a good number?
You know, that's a personal thing. I mean, every business does take there's amount of administration to any business, right? I mean, there's overhead for all businesses. Absolutely. Absolutely. But depending on the size of that organization, like how much is coming in, how much are they doing, how big is the game that they're doing, I think it needs to be proportionate to that size of the business, right? But when you see these businesses or the nonprofits, a lot of these are just being run as basically a business with a nonprofit status. But if they're not doing, I mean, 50-50, that's horrendous. Horrendous. So I guess I don't want to throw a number out there saying this is good, this is not bad. But what I would do is advise people, like there's organizations out there called Charity Navigator. That's one of them that rates these nonprofits. Nonprofits have to file a form each year. I think it's a 990 or something like that. But there's a form that they have to file each year and disclose the financials.
So Charity Navigator.
Charity Navigator.
Okay.
There's an app you can do on your iPhone or pull up in a browser, but you can research a nonprofit.
That's great stuff.
And find out the financials and do your homework for yourself.
Now, why don't you transition now, kind of what brought you to Texas, let's say, and talk more about the organization you're working with.
Yeah. So we're from Michigan, where we get 3 months of beautiful weather. So we were just itching to find somewhere else to go. But no, in all seriousness, I mean, we built our company because we wanted to be mobile. So one, we built the business around what we wanted. But two, we had opportunity to move down here and do something really incredible. So we are partners in Warriors Heart, which is the first fully private treatment center for warriors, which is veterans, military, law enforcement, first responders. It's a treatment center dealing with PTSD and chemical dependencies. So we purchased a 543-acre ranch in the San Antonio area in December of 2015. And we were licensed April of 2016. So we've been up and running for about a year almost now.
Amazing stuff. I've been to that facility with you and you've given me the tour and it's impressive. And tell me more about the treatment they get and kind of the how it works. Because this is an organization, I think it's well done.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, you know, I kind of share that stat with you. 22 veterans a day commit suicide. And the reality is people are dealing with trauma. People are dealing with stress. People are dealing with PTSD. And it's real. It's real. And, you know, I've seen too many families that have been torn apart. And I've struggled with PTSD. I mean, I'll be very open about that, you know. And it takes work to work through those things. And what is PTSD? I'll tell you what PTSD is. It's a normal reaction to abnormal circumstances. And the problem with this generation of conflicts is the repetition and the intensity of the engagements, it's nonstop. We're still at war. We've been at war for 16 years. Unfortunately, most people don't even realize we're still at war. And actually, just this week, they finally announced that we're in Syria. We have conventional troops in Syria on the ground. We have Marines and Army Rangers on the ground in Syria right now today, engaging in combat. So 16 years, you have a force of people doing multiple tours. I did two. I knew if I did three, you know, I was past the point of return, you know, and there's a true cost to that. There's a true cost to that, both psychologically as a person dealing with all these mixed emotions, and there's emotional pain and emotional injury, you know, from some of these things. So it's not that someone's broken or someone is, you know, no good anymore, but do you need professional help to work through those things?
Tell me more about the folks that come into your program.
Yeah. So to come into our program, you have to have both PTSD and chemical dependency. And what we see is a lot of people just aren't dealing with their issues. So I have a good buddy of mine who laid on top of me in the firefight. So I'm very close to this person and feel much indebtedness to him. But he struggled. And I watched it happen. And he was hitting the bottle of Jack daily, you know, and he was drinking a lot. And he ended up losing his job, lost his wife, lost his kids, lost his house, lost his family when he beat up his dad. I mean, he lost everything. Yeah, he hit rock bottom. And that was the point to me when I saw what he went through and I saw the environment. He went through the VA program for substance abuse. And we drove down to Indianapolis to see him, and they put him in the ghetto. They put him up in the projects in between two liquor stores right there in the corner of his street. And it pissed me off. Mm-hmm. I mean, here was a guy who's crying out for help, and I'm not bashing the VA at all. I am not. I think the VA absolutely has a purpose and a place. But this thing is so large and so big, and there's so many people returning with issues. And as a sidebar, I don't think you can not return without some kind of an issue, right? Like, there's just a natural, there's some hurt there. So just seeing that, it's like, this, there's got to be a better way. And so that's really the driving force, you know, behind our involvement in Warrior's Heart. And that's why we do what we do. We love business. We are a for-profit venture. We're very open about that. We believe in using entrepreneurship and business for good. We believe in the foundation, the ideals of what this country is built upon, not handouts, but hard work, you know, elbow grease, busting your butt and making something happen. We believe in that. We believe in the esprit de corps and the camaraderie of what the military was about for us. And so when you bring that kind of environment where people are the warrior class, that's where healing can happen. Because when you're talking to someone that doesn't understand it, they don't get it. They have no clue. They can't comprehend what you're talking about. So people won't open up. They won't share some of that trauma that they're going through or dealing with unless they have people that can understand it. You know, you have to be able to talk the language. You have to be able to have that humor and the jokes and be able to be relatable. And at that point, guys open up, and that's where healing can begin. So you have to remove the chemical dependencies. You have to remove the drowning themselves out until they can get down to the heart of it in dealing with those issues that they have. It's that simple.
So this first location could be the first of many, you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We have gotten an overwhelming need. Let me just put it that way. Mm-hmm. You know, just since April, I've seen 600 contacts. I think I just looked at this just the other day here. People reaching out to us for help. So it's a huge problem. And we know we're not going to solve all the problem, but we're sure as heck going to try and make a dent.
I think it's a great organization. I think there's a need. I think you guys are doing a phenomenal job out there, and I want to support it. And you and I were able to come up with an idea that we probably could share to our listeners and how we can support that. Yeah. Should we kick that around?
Absolutely, man.
So one of the things that you and I talked about was creating a referral system. For example, we here in Texas, we have a $50 cap for a referral to an owner to bring us a property management client. And so I think that's fooey. I think that's, you know, so low, it's not even a coffee someplace sometimes. So what we're doing is we're going to donate a large amount, and right now it's 500, but I'm going to kick that up to 1,000 here pretty quick. We're donating $1,000 for every property management referral to Warrior's Heart Foundation. And so when we do this, you guys are going to support us by getting us a written proof that we made a charitable donation.
Absolutely.
We're going to make that in the owner's behalf. We're going to make sure the owner has a copy of that and the new owner that they bring in. So this is our plan, is to bring this idea to other property management companies. We want them to look at a way to give their owners an incentive to refer them business. And this is not a new concept. You've always heard, you know, you buy a latte at McDonald's and 50 cents goes to the Ronald McDonald House. Well, that's the same concept we're doing here in management. Is if they can give us referral for more business, we want to make a donation of a real amount to an awesome organization. And I think Warrior's Heart's a great place to do it. And I've seen it. I've seen it in person. I've been a little jaded with some of the news coming out for some of the organizations. Mm-hmm. I don't see anything like that with your organization. I think it's going to be one of those that you're going to see a positive impact. And then I think it's going to grow into numerous markets where it's not just in the Texas area. You guys were talking to going in different markets already. And the backing you have, and I don't want to elaborate too much because I'll probably butcher it, but I'm impressed with the backing you have. Some of the names that you have dropped on me have been big players in the States. And I can't even, I wish I could say more, but let's just say if those people heard the names on the podcast, they'd probably know who we're talking about. Yeah. And I'm not going to share any of them. But point being is that's the kind of backing you have. That's the kind of support you're getting because you are a stand-up organization. So tell me more about what you think of that referral program idea.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, to go a step further here real quick, you know, if you're ever in the San Antonio area, come on down. You know, just today I was at the Heart. We call it the Heart. And I was showing the peer support leader that runs the PTSD clinic here in San Antonio at the VA at San Antonio. And I was showing him the property today, and he couldn't believe it. You know, it was great. And so we're looking at already a partnership there where they're going to refer people to us, and that's great. And so I loved his comment. It was like, we're fighting the same war. Absolutely. You know, this is the same war. So together we can accomplish so much more. This problem's so big. It's not about the VA or private, or, you know, hey, there's such a need. We just want to start healing people, healing families, so they can live their life.
Yeah, you get out to that place, 540 acres. People don't realize how big that is, but it's a big place, and it just de-escalates all the stress you feel like you have on you, because you just get up there in the big wide open spaces and out in the woods a little bit, and it just de-escalates everything. I love it out there.
Yeah, and that's the intent. You know, that's the point. And you know, it's to go back to your question about what do I think about the referral program, I think it's awesome. I think that people need to realize that they are truly making an impact in people's lives. We've had people come to us already on multiple occasions where we knew that they were coming to us, or they weren't ever coming back from anything. So, I mean, like, literally they were at that point, the end of their ropes. And I see every single contact submission that comes in asking for help. I see where these people are at. And when they reach out to us, they're at the end of the road. And so for every person that we can get into the program, make, you know, give them that fighting chance. I mean, we're saving lives.
To me, it's a tangible contribution. You know, and we've talked about this before. So if I give a donation to X charity, I have no idea where that's going. Mm-hmm. I have no facility. There's some corporate office in New York or something, for all I know. You never know where that money's going. And I've heard stories of it being siphoned off for parties and big salaries and wages. Mm-hmm. And you told me some of those. And that just kind of turns me off.
Absolutely.
But I tell you, when you can go to San Antonio, fly into the San Antonio airport and drive an hour and see this place, that's a pretty tangible thing that people can get their hands around and understand that their donation is going for a very good charity, very good event.
And I want to put this out a little bit further, just to make sure this is clear. This isn't just military. We call it the warrior class. So that's military, law enforcement, first responders. I mean, law enforcement, man.
I would say they'd see more, if not worse.
It's been brutal the last couple of years in this country, you know, and these guys, every day in and day out, you know, they don't just have a rotation, a deployment. I mean, they're doing the grind every single day, and cops are hated on today. You know, it's sad. It's disgusting. It's not right. But there's a lot of trauma and stress from law enforcement. So I just want to make sure that's clear. To us, that's the warrior class. The warrior class is those who are defending our way of life, defending our communities that we live in, defending our kids. So we need to honor and protect and to treat and help and cure.
Veterans, law enforcement, first responders,
firemen, they come in
for a regimented treatment program. I mean, it's a certain number of days, and they can graduate to a certain level, and there's all kinds of, you know, good sessions in there to kind of get them some help that they need. You're getting referrals to from a lot of major places that you're kind of like the next level. Not necessarily like a go-between, but you got, you know, the guys that are really, or the people that are potentially very, very, very messed up mentally to society, you're kind of being that bridge, let's say.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're not like a psychiatric hospital, right?
No,
so we're not dealing with that kind of stuff. What we're dealing with is we're dealing with PTSD and TBI. You know, that's the extent
Explain
of our
the TBI.
So TBI is traumatic brain injury.
Okay.
So one of the signature wounds of, you know, the last 16 years, these wars is the damage from the concussions of big explosions. You know, and I was in serious explosions, and that has an effect on your brain when your brain's getting rocked around. So PTSD and TBI are the two signature wounds from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and now Syria.
So long-term goals, give me a couple long-term goals you want to talk about for your involvement with Warrior's Heart.
Yeah. Long-term goals for Warrior's Heart. I mean, it's still very, very new. So we're still very involved in building it, but kind of the same thing as we do the property management, and just being very involved, very engaged, and figuring out, making it work. And we are, and it's the need is there. This thing works, our treatment works, and now it's just scaling it, getting attention, getting awareness, getting people into the program. So that's where we're focused right now. We're working on partnerships with TRICARE, which is the military's insurance, and working with the VA directly as well too. So those are our two big things, our two big goals right now. And once that happens, we can really open the floodgates. So right now, our biggest hurdle is the financial cost. There is a cost. We have a team of about 30 people on staff, you know, MD doctors, we have clinicians, we have therapists. I mean, we have very well-trained people, but there's a cost for that. And so the biggest problem that we have today is just getting people in the program. So we're offering them scholarships. And so that's what the money that you're referring to, this $500, every $500 is huge, man. It is a huge impact, because if we can get another person in there, you're saving a family, you're saving a life, you're giving someone hope. That is huge.
We want to double down on that pretty quick,
and
too.
And that's dignity of person. That's giving. And then when they go through that, there's an obligation that they feel towards whoever, you know, helped get them through that tough period of their life. So this is not a handout. This is a hand up. And, mm-hmm. and that's what resonates with our generation of warriors.
And they're given to a charity. So it's a donation for the property management company owner.
Yep.
Okay. So absolutely. I just want to make sure that's clear.
Yep. We have a foundation that is a 501c3. So it's absolutely a taxable charitable contribution.
Okay, good. Just want to be clear on that for the financial side.
Absolutely.
So how do people get in touch with you and see more about the Warrior's Heart?
Yeah. So they can go to warriorsheart.com. Just Google warriorsheart.com or go to warriorsheart.com. You can find out everything about our program on there. You can find out about our team. You know, you can even read about me on there. I mean, you can find out all the information about the program right there, but there's also a donate button right there as well. If you do feel inclined to donate, and you know, we'd be honored if you would. But at the same time to us, number one is awareness. The more people that are just aware of what's going on, to me, that's probably the biggest goal is awareness.
So if a management company owner wanted to reach out to you and say, how do I put this into our business? Your team would be able to assist them.
Absolutely.
Put that referral program idea into their business so you could start seeing the rewards of that, not only, you know, potentially with more referrals, but darn it, you're making a good cause do something.
Yeah. I mean, you can email me directly, justin@warriorsheart.com. That's justin@warriorsheart.com. And we would absolutely be happy and thrilled to get that set up just the same way that we've done it with you, Brad.
Great, Justin. I appreciate it. Thanks so much for coming on the Property Management Mastermind Show. It's been a great interview. Got pretty deep there. And I appreciate all your time with this. We're very excited to be able to put this out. I know the Warrior's Heart's going to do very well. And I'm hoping to teach a lot of management company owners this exact technique so we can get you guys built up and out to where it's a common household name and you're helping thousands of first responders and veterans in law enforcement. That's what we want.
Yeah, so, thanks. Our goal is to bring 1 million warriors home.
1 million warriors
1 million.
That's a great quantify goal. Love it. Again, Justin, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Today's show has been sponsored by Virtually Incredible, providing tenant screening services, call center services, and video production services to property managers. You may also visit them at virtuallyincredible.com.
This has been a podcast episode by PropertyManagementProductions.com. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast, leave us feedback, and come back for our next episode.